Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are ready to start paper 42. So right at the beginning of paper 42, that is old single column, page 467. All right, so finished up the first of the two papers here on universes of things. That was basically the, you know, very big picture side of it, the basically astronomy side of it. Now more directly to the physics. The details of the nature of matter itself, you know, a little less about how it's implemented in macroscopic scales. All right. One little thing to note is they start out this paper similarly to how they started out the paper 41 with a big picture, setting the cosmic context for the details that they then get into after that. The issue of that it's a cosmos, it's a harmonizing universe, and harmonizing doesn't just automatically come out of the stuff. There are beings. There's a whole coordinated system in which these physical phenomena exist. And so they want to start out by making sure that you're reminded again of that up front before you start burrowing down into all of the factual details, again, because they're constantly trying to get you to focus first on the truths that you can acquire a relationship to before you try to pick through all the details of the facts, right? So that you don't get things turned around and get lost in the facts, not recognizing how much of a pre-existent worldview that you're interpreting those facts in. You're missing the truth, the reformation of your worldview that's they're wanting you to acquire before you try to burrow into the details and do a very specific comparison with the way those details are currently being thought about, or whether or not those details are being currently thought about in any way, all those sorts of factual things. The science side should be second. You want to put the philosophy, the philosophic picture first. And a true philosophic picture always involves beings in one way or another. Universe is mind-made and personality managed in every way, shape, and form. Yes, there are times when you can, at least a first order, neglect perhaps and the influence of beings and just treat the basic mechanics of the situation. But at some point, over a long enough span of time or over a large enough scope of content of space, you're going to need to take into account that cosmic fact, that harmonizing is coming from that personality management. Okay, let's jump in here.
Paper 42, Energy, Mind, and Matter. The foundation of the universe is material in the sense that energy is the basis of all existence, and pure energy is controlled by the universal Father. Force, energy, is the one thing which stands as an everlasting monument demonstrating and proving the existence and presence of the universal absolute. This vast stream of energy proceeding from the paradise presences has never lapsed, never failed. There has never been a break in the infinite upholding.
Okay. Doesn't that feel pretty sweeping to begin with?
Yeah,
very much so. Trying to start with a very big picture. Okay, now let's start with the title of the paper. They're going to point out that they're going to use the word energy most of the time in a general mode. You can just see that in the title that there's two different flavors of quote-unquote energy that they're going to be focusing on. Mind energy on the one hand, material energy on the other. And the order, when you have blank and blank anywhere in the book, the order is always important. You are to pause and consider. If they put it in that order, if they say mind and matter rather than matter and mind, which is the foundational word?
Mind.
No, it's the second one. Yep.
It had to be one of the two.
It had to be one of the two. The way the pairs go, like if they say source and center, right? The center is the foundational one. If they say center and source, then the source is the foundation one. So here, they're very purposely putting it mind and matter. So you're thinking matter is the foundation, and then mind is added on top of that. You could drop the and if it was, in line in a sentence, they might do that and put a hyphen between the two and say mind hyphen matter means the same thing. The hyphen is substituting for the and. And again, that's the second word. That's the foundation word. The one before the hyphen is modifying it.
So you'd think mind would come before matter. That's not what you're talking about.
Right. But it depends on the mode they're in the book. Which way order they'll put it in. It isn't some absolute thing that if you ever write them matter in mind, you've just made some absolute error, completely invalid. No. Look at how the first sentence starts. The foundation of the universe is material. Isn't that what we just said? That matter is the foundational word in that pair. I see. They're fundamentally not starting you off in a top-down mode where you're thinking spirit, downstepped through a hierarchy of mind and seated down at the bottom on matter. That's not the mode they're in. They're in a bottom-up mode, very fundamentally. It's the universes of things. I mean, that's appropriate. We're trying to really understand that foundation of the material. And it is a foundation in a way that humans have never imagined. The foundation of the universe is material in the sense that energy is the basis of all existence. Okay, what does that mean? Okay, the word energy, especially if you're using it in a very general sense, you want to always be thinking that means there's a differential. It's basically a synonym for differential. A differential in reality. So if you're saying spirit energy, you're talking about a particular flavor of differential. We're going to be talking a lot about, at least especially initially here in this paper, about physical energy. That kind of a differential, a physical differential. So in the sense that differential, that energy, is the basis of all existence. If you start with, in the conceptual beginning was the I am. Remember, it's an infinite concept. That capital I, capital A, capital M. Concept. So it's not like it's lacking in quantity or even quality. It's infinite in quality too. So why is it that there's something besides the I am? Why isn't that complete to begin with, if it's the infinite I am? You know, it's perfectly homogeneous and isotropic, the same in every place, the same in every direction. Isn't that what your spiritual consciousness, you know, feels is the end point? We could just get everything equal from place to place and in every direction. You know, perfect equality. You know, what's the one thing that's missing in the I am, that concept of the I am?
Relationship.
True relationship. True, you know, genuine, differential. Right? Differential is the basis of all existence. That's the only reason anything exists, to create differential and to produce the superadditive consequences that results from that differential. If you short-circuit it, you know, in your pure spiritual consciousness desire, then there's no potential and everything goes static and dead. You know, it's only living if there's differential. There's only genuine potential if there's differential. See, so that's what they're getting at. Energy, you know, that literalization of differential is the basis of all existence. It couldn't be anything more important to understand than what they're about to talk about when they say it that way. And pure energy is controlled by the Universal Father. Okay, we're going to get to the specifics of pure energy, but remember the expression pure energy is a synonym for primordial force, for the force charge of space. And, you know, you hear me bring it up all the time. You know, they'll mention it in this paper. That idea that, you know, so you think about that other thing that you're very interested in that comes from the Father, thought adjusters, Father fragments. You know, lay out in your mind all the Father fragments in front of you. And you turn those around conceptually in your mind, and what's on the other side? The force charge of space. The Father fragments are, quote-unquote, pure spirit. You flip it around, it's pure energy. But they're actually, you know, this one and the same thing. Because there is no difference between energy and spirit in the Father. Father is a fact that exists prior to the differentiation between the absolute of matter, the Isle of Paradise, and the absolute spirit, the eternal Son. Spirit and matter are one in the Father. So that we, from a finite point of view, we think of, you know, matter and spirit being at the end points, you know, of a polarity, right? But that's a little reminder. It's like, well, okay, so if that's the nature of it, that they're at the end points, then pure energy should be all the way to one end point and pure spirit should be all the way to the other end point. But if they're actually one and the same thing, oh, so it isn't actually a line, it wraps around. You know, and that's actually one fact. You know, and it's two sides of the same fact. Okay? All right, so that we'll get into that more in context, but that idea that pure spirit, pure energy, is the personal ministry of the Universal Father. Okay, so hence them saying pure energy is controlled by the Universal Father. Okay, just the fact that they bring in the Universal Father right away is telling you something about how they're going to start. They're going to start us the way we always tend to start, with the individuality viewpoint. There, you'll see that in very short order, they are going to be making suggestions about deity, but they want you to try to initially understand what's going on with the seven absolutes of infinity and that individuality viewpoint, that basic idea that you ought to already have in some way, even in, with a limited monotheistic viewpoint, that there's a creator. You know, and you You want to try to initially understand how there's a creator behind everything, that there's a first cause, you know, that creator, and everything stems from that first cause, a first source and center of all things and beings. But we're focusing on things immediately right now. Okay, so they're in that mode, and then they say, force, parenthetically energy, is the one thing that stands as an everlasting monument demonstrating and proving the existence and presence of the universal absolute. Okay, from the time viewpoint, again, an initial viewpoint, we think about that differential between the deity absolute and the unqualified absolute. That differential literally is the universal absolute. So, you know, you notice they're starting us off in many ways with force. You know, they mentioned pure energy, the primordial force, but they put that parenthetical, force, comma, energy, because in a higher sense, in a more general sense, a force is an energy. It's a differential of some sort. Okay, so, and when we finally get to the details and we talk about it more of a sequence where we use the word energy a little more specifically and we say force, energy, power, you know, or we say primordial force, emergent energy, universe, power, you know, we think of the energy and the power as coming from the force. That's the beginning fact. You know, so here they're basically saying that beginning fact, which is a differential, comma, energy, right? See, is the one thing which stands as an everlasting monument demonstrating and proving the existence and presence of the reservoir of the potential for all differential, right?
Force be with you.
Right? Okay? So, the universal absolute, you know, is that fundamentally the embodiment of that differential. So that's all they're saying, just reminding you of that. That's how you logically understand where the actuality of differential came from. It came out of that reservoir of potential. If you see an actuality of differential, it didn't come from nowhere, so that just proves that the reservoir is lurking somewhere unseen. There has to be a reservoir of potential from which that actuality came from. Yeah?
Is not the universal absolute the reservoir for potential, reservoir for a mind?
Okay, so a lot of times in a simpler fashion, we speak of the three reservoirs, the unqualified absolute, the universal absolute, the deity absolute, as a reservoir of the potential for matter, the reservoir of the potential for mind, the reservoir of the potential for spirit, in that order. Here we're recognizing a little bit more generally. There's a reservoir of potential for individuality, a reservoir of the potential for associativity, a reservoir of the potential for unity. That associativity, that differential, associativity embodies differential. Individuality on one end, unity on the other end, right? That's the fundamental differential. See, so in a more philosophic sense, it's the reservoir of the potential for the actuality of differential, for manifested differential. A specific example of differential made literal, made energy, is mind energy. Right? But in a more general sense, differential in general, see, and mind is a specific example of differential, made stuff, kind of. Right? Okay. And you know, so then they just point out that you're thinking of a paradise source for all of this energy phenomenon. You know, and it just you know, it's the eternal Isle of Paradise. So, not surprisingly, what stems from that source, you know, never lapses, you know, never fails. It, you know, it's just going to be this eternal like phenomenon. And then look what they throw in at the end. There has never been a break in the infinite upholding. They couldn't get out of the first paragraph before they gave you a little taste of deity. You know, if you go from the individuality viewpoint of looking at the universal absolute, if you flip it around to the unity viewpoint, the deity perspective, what is it? The infinite upholder, right? See, infinite upholding, right? So they're just reminding you, don't forget that you can flip the reality perspective around to the deity perspective, and then instead of contemplating the reality of the universal absolute, you know, as they just said, you know, demonstrating and proving the existence, you know, the reality of the universal absolute, if you flip that around, you have the infinite upholder, that facet of deity, which is a facet of the Father. Oh, kind of another way to think about it, in a less individuality way, about their them invoking the universal Father. They're tied to pure energy. Okay? All right, so see, that's what they're doing. You know, we spent a lot of minutes there just talking about that first paragraph. I won't necessarily do this all the time, but I want to just, you know, with every paragraph, right? But I want you to appreciate, you know, that it's always like that. You know, I occasionally just mention it in passing that, you know, we could talk for a whole 2 hours on this one paragraph. I mean, there's all of that rich depth that's always there to appreciate. Just notice every detail. You know, and they didn't put, you know, the capital I infinite, capital U upholder. You know, they put it in lowercase because we're not literally thinking of the facet of deity. We're in the reality perspective. We're trying to think about energy, you know, literally the reality of energy. You know, but there's an infinite upholding, lowercase, you know, letters behind that, you know, if you will. All right.
The manipulation of energy, of universe energy, is ever in accordance with the personal will and the all-wise mandates of the Universal Father. This personal control of manifested power and circulating energy is modified by the coordinate acts and decisions of the Eternal Son, as well as by the united purposes of the Son and the Father executed by the conjoined actor. These divine beings act personally and as individuals. They also function in the persons and powers of an almost unlimited number of subordinates, each variously expressive of the eternal and divine purpose in the universe of universes. But these functional and provisional modifications or transmutations of divine power in no way lessen the truth of the statement that all force energy is under the ultimate control of a personal God resident at the center of all things.
Okay. All right, so they're trying to still obviously solidify the validity, like I said, of your initial thinking that there has to be a creator, if not an upholder, right? As well, you know, initiates and maintains, you know, that there's a fact like that in the universe. But they're already starting to transition you away from just a simple little viewpoint where you're just going to kind of maybe stick in your initial primitive religious consciousness and think about some magic wand waver and bringing stuff into existence. You know, they're bringing in other characters, other actors in the play. And, you know, the first thing they do is mention the three, of course, the three infinite persons. And in the process, using the word coordinate, okay? And, you know, if you're in the know, You know what they're pointing you towards. Three persons, coordination, they're pointing you towards the Paradise Trinity and the Mother. But before they get to that specific, which you'll see they'll get to here in a little bit, they're still trying to motivate, keep it in the individuality viewpoint where you're thinking about the seven absolutes infinity to start with. But then they're throwing in and almost countless retinue of others, at the same time. And you're going, this feeling like there needs to be an umbrella over this whole cast of characters, not just the three, but all the countless others. The whole, the Paradise Trinity, is what's going to be, you're going to finally recognize is overarching all of this into a single coordinated whole. All right, let's see, but they stress against you at the very beginning. They want you to initially appreciate, before you get into really the science, to appreciate that mind-made, personality-managed thing, so, that's going to be a person, that's a first source and center. The manipulation of universe energy is ever in accordance with a personal will and the all-wise mandates of the Universal Father. But then at the end, they come back around to that, saying, but now technically, see, appreciate that that's in truth. In fact, it's not the Universal Father who has his fingers on all of the details and is micromanaging it or anything. Okay? The Father has hands, and he has delegated those hands off of his body. Right? See, so how notice how they word that at the end. But these functional and provisional modifications or transmutations of divine power in no way lessen the truth of the statement. But it did modify the facts. Right? The Universal Father doesn't in fact do these things, but in truth he does. Especially when you're thinking of things from the individuality viewpoint, everything goes back to a first source and center. And so all of the actions of all the subordinates are predicated on that first cause. Yes. But see, that's back in eternity, not down there in the details of time. And they're the truths of eternity. Yes, so in truth, yes. But in fact, the facts of time, it's a different matter. You have master physical controllers and whatnot. Okay, yep.
Could you explain why you would use differential to define energy? Seems like energy is used here in a way more specific to the physical sciences.
Yes, we're focusing on physical sciences, but if they say spirit energy, are they talking about physical science? No, they're not. You got to remember. They'll stress it. When we get into the paper a little bit, that they have to use a word like energy in a generalized way that goes way beyond anything that we've ever thought about it. And I'm trying to help you to understand what the key point is that allows it to be generalized. If you take the word energy as it's used in say E equals mc squared. The E there in Einstein's equation there, and you focus in on, in that sense, energy has something to do with, most of the time with photons. And so if they say spirit energy, they must mean that spirit photons. No, that isn't how they want you to generalize the word energy. You're focusing on the wrong specific, before you generalized. You want to focus in on the key, not so much scientific, but philosophic fact of, though even how current science uses the word energy. It's a differential. You know, you speak of a potential for an energy. And then the actualization of that energy. And if you stick your hand in the way of the actualization of that energy, you'll feel a differential. You'll go, ow. Right? Right? Energy fundamentally embodies a differential, a sharpness, a contrast. A spark across an electric gap, right? You literally have to make a material construct that has a gap, that has a break, that has a differential in it in order to produce that energy that's the spark across the gap. See, the fact that that energy is fundamentally a differential is just right there in front of you, and the fact that the capacitor or whatever has two plates separated by a certain distance, a differential. So that's the beginning. Is they're getting you? They're sort of validating your first source and center monotheistic God creator thing, and then beginning to expand on it. And as I mentioned, as we begin to move now into the details in the first section, they're going to transition you more to the science. And you'll see what happens as they do that, as they transition you away from kind of the philosophic big picture, getting you to focus in on the specifics, the science more directly. You'll see what happens to the cast of characters.
Yeah. I'd say one thing also, that to me, this, when I first read this, when I first was reading the Rancho book, it really helped expand my understanding of God. More than just like the first part of the book that talks about God, but you really understand that, when all is said and done, from my point of view, God's definitely in control. He's got it from the beginning to the end. The whole thing about, is ultimately in control, a personal God, resident in the center of all things.
Right.
It was very comforting to me.
Right.
Which was different, of a God who just manipulates the things that are out there. What a lot of people, unfortunately, a lot of people believe God's some gray-haired old guy, sitting up there, doing this and that. And so I think that helped.
Yes. See, and that's what I'm trying to stress. That core philosophic fact that there's, or truth, I should say, that they're stressing at the end there, that you just, repeated, that a personal God resident at the center of all things. Now, once that's firmly established, you can say, okay, now exactly how does he do this? He is obviously the ultimate why, the ultimate control, the ultimate why behind it all. But what about the how? What about the science?
But it also makes you trust it more.
Yeah.
It makes you, trust that that's whenever you do discover the how and the why, that it's going
to
be.
That's what I'm trying to get you to appreciate. You can trust science if it begins with philosophy. You can't trust it if it doesn't. You can't trust religion if it doesn't begin with a philosophic overarching perspective. That, for the science and the religion to be trustworthy, they need to be true. And the only way they can be true is if you come at them from the top down, through philosophy to an individuality-specific science, through philosophy to a unity-specific religion. That's what they're doing. So even though we are talking bottom up by the seven absolutes, we're also doing top down in terms of understanding, so that we're in full comfort of what's going on before we burrow into the details, so that fear can't enter in, or concern or anything. It's like, you have complete assurance everything is okay, because there's a personal God resident at the center of all things. What could possibly go wrong? Right? Okay, so now let's get into the details.
One, paradise forces and energies. The foundation of the universe is material, but the essence of life is spirit. The father of spirits is also the ancestor of universes. The eternal father of the original sun is also the eternity source of the original pattern, the Isle of Paradise.
Okay, so they repeat that opening statement, you know, that is, pointed out as in, directly embodied in the title of the paper, the foundation of the universe is material. But now they're bringing in spirit more directly. The essence of life is spirit. Okay, so why say it that way? Remember how I often point out, what's the difference between the two substances in a very fundamental philosophic way? Matter is non-self-animating substance. Spirit is self-animating substance. Life animation, right? The essence of life is spirit. So before you actually literally think abstractly about a separate fact called life animation, just start with an initial contrast of the two substances. And matter in and of itself is not animate, but spirit substance is, right? And so it's an easy way to begin to understand if there's going to be what we call life, there must be some relationship to spirit, either directly or indirectly. You talk about the creative mother spirit, as being a source of life animation, for instance. You're not going to be surprised if you see the word spirit and the word life in close association in sentences. Okay, the easiest way, like I said, is to appreciate how that connection is just, you imagine if you take the life animation out of the spirit substance, then you have life animation, and you can apply that to material substance if it's properly constructed. And that brings them into a closeness that they didn't have before. You're beginning to bridge that separation between the matter and the spirit. But the other thing that they're doing there is, what I pointed out when they mentioned pure energy. They're saying, okay, now remember, if you're going to be focusing on energy, you're going to tend to be thinking about the relationship of the first source and center of the Isle of Paradise and all those sorts of issues. But don't forget, there's an equal relationship of the first source and center to the second source and center, equal to that relationship to the Paradise source and center, or the Universal Father to the Eternal Son, or as they're saying it here, the Eternal Father of the Original Son, at the same time, the eternity source of the original pattern of the Isle of Paradise. So what are they doing? They're backing you up and reminding you that even when you're thinking with just the seven absolutes of infinity, if you go all the way back to the source point of your material consideration, there you meet the spirit, and there's no separation. So at the source point, they're together as one. They're doing that because we're eventually going to flip things around. So I'll just keep that in mind, and I'll pick that up when we get a little deeper into this section. That what they're trying to do is get you to remind you that when you're down in the details playing with the matter issues, material issues, you can't forget that there must be a closeness of spirit in play, because after all, if you follow the matter stuff all the way back to the source, there's no separation with spirit. So don't be fooled thinking that down in the trenches that somehow spirit must be completely out of the picture. Okay, there's a triunity always there of matter, mind, and spirit. Okay, and you can just logically appreciate how that must be, because if you follow back in the simple source model like we're doing here, there's no separation between pure energy and pure spirit in the first source and center. Okay, they're even bringing in the issue of the difference between spirit pattern, personality, and energy pattern, or just pattern. the eternity source of the original pattern. Remember that the difference between energy pattern and spirit pattern is not a difference in the reservoir that is the Father either. They're one and the same pattern. He only doles out one kind of pattern. He actually doesn't dole out two kinds of pattern. It's just that when that pattern engages the actuality, it manifests one side or the other. It manifests the spirit pattern side or the energy pattern side. But in some transcendent sense, they are one and the same thing. That's why you can eventually have a power personality synthesis. If they weren't fundamentally the same purposing, they could never come together in a synthesis like that. And speaking of purposing, did you notice in that second paragraph in the preface there, they talked about all the countless individuals, you know, each variously expressive of the eternal and divine purpose? Right? The pattern is the purposing. Right? It's all about the distribution of purposing throughout the whole system. All right, let's keep going.
Matter, energy, for they are but diverse manifestations of the same cosmic reality, as a universe phenomena, is inherent in the universal Father. Quote, in him all things consist, end quote. Matter may appear to manifest inherent energy and to exhibit self-contained powers, but the lines of gravity involved in the energies concerned in all these physical phenomena are derived from and are dependent on paradise. The automaton, the first measurable form of energy, has paradise as its nucleus.
Okay, there's that sentence we've been vectoring toward for a long time, yes. Okay, so let's start at the beginning.
An hour talking about
so
Pam's not here.
So you noticed that they did something a little bit different than what they did in the first paragraph, where they said force, comma, energy. Here they went matter, and basically, the M dashes are like a super comma. Matter, parenthetically, energy. Okay? Again, in the same spirit, energy is the general word. Force is a differential. Matter is a differential. They're all differentials in the general sense. For they are but diverse manifestations of the same cosmic reality. Everything is a differential, all of reality. Another reason why you can think of, why of the three absolutes, the one has the universal adjective, because it's, really everything that's experienceable comes from that reservoir. The endpoints are not directly experienceable. From an experiential perspective, that is, all of cosmic reality, what's coming from that differential. The stasis, basically, of the endpoints is not experienceable. So it's the universal reservoir, the universal absolute. All right. So matter, energy, for there, but diverse manifestations of the same cosmic reality, as a universe phenomenon is inherent in the universal Father. In him all things consist. And so, you're kind of bringing up and throwing in a little bit of Paul from the Bible there. That's Colossians, if I remember correctly. That idea that if you're thinking in terms of a first source and center of all things and beings, then, in him all things consist. Everything stands together in his encompassment. Okay? So we're just kind of re-stressing that, but we're going to evolve away to, but what about down in the trenches and the details? What's more immediately the science of that? All right, and then again, kind of reminding you of, you're studying matter, Matter may appear to manifest inherent energy and to exhibit self-contained powers, but it isn't self-sourced. There's a source behind everything. Okay, you know, you're looking at the manifestation. There's always something behind the scenes, you know, and if you penetrate to that behind the scenes, there's something behind those scenes and behind those scenes and behind those scenes. So you're always looking at a projection. You know, the analogy that a lot of times works is the iceberg analogy. You know, you're looking at what's above the surface of the water, but don't ever forget that there's a lot more than what meets the eye beneath the surface. Right? There's always this foundational nature that initially goes unrecognized. They're telling you up front, don't ever forget that if you're just focusing on the physical manifestation, you follow it back, you go from a finite manifestation, at a deeper level there's an absonite. At the deepest level, though, there's going to be an absolute foundation to that physical manifestation, that finite physical manifestation. The automaton, the first measurable form of energy, has paradise as its nucleus. Okay, let's take the parenthetical first. The first measurable form of energy. You know, we're going to get to the details here shortly. We start with primordial force, and then, you know, from that we get emergent energy, specifically automatons. Okay. But that source, the immediate source for those automatons, the force charge of space, okay, is not measurable. Okay, in a higher sense, like they said to be in force, comma, energy, it is an energy, okay, but it's not a measurable form of energy. Measurable in the finite sense. Okay? So you cannot think of that which pervades all space, the force charge of space, as something that you can tap into. You know, if it's not measurable, it's definitely not tappable to, you know, power light bulbs or whatever.
It's not okay? Charge as we think of it.
You know, it's charge in the general sense, not, you know, it's not like positive negative charge, you know, but like, man, I'm charged. Okay. Right? Okay. Space is charged, is pervaded, is filled. Okay? With a fact, but it is not what some people have imagined, and some still continue to imagine, something that's like the ether concept. Okay, that which pervades space, the force charge, is not like the ether, most fundamentally because it's not tappable, it's not measurable, it is, you know, it is below anything. You can't think of it as there's this all-pervasive, you know, mystical energy reservoir that I can build a fancy gizmo and plug into and have endless power or something like that. That it, you know, variations on the ether idea are that, you know, that it's an electronic level energy, you know, presence that's just everywhere that you can plug into in some fancy way. No. Okay? That's the very fundamental difference. There is no such, you know, universal reservoir like that that you can tap into. No zero point energy, no, you know, whatever the heck someone might call it in their rationalization scheme. Yep.
they call automaton measurable.
Right.
Would that be indicative that there may come a time when we can discern it, measure it?
Yes. For those of you on the webinars, why don't you say, the automaton is measurable? Will there come a time when we can measure it? And the answer is yes. They're going to refer to it shortly. You know, like I said, we're talking about measurable from a finite perspective. The force charge is a differential. But it's absonite. If you can build an absonite device, You could measure the force charge as a differential, as an energy. But you can't. And so that's why they don't call it an energy in a specific, you know, in a specific sense. They call it a force, a pre-energy.
Okay? Wouldn't be any good here anyway.
Right? It's not finitely measurable. The subtlest differential that can be measured in any by even the highest finite, you know, the most refined finite instrument that they have on Uversa or something, is an automaton. No finite being on Uversa can measure the differential of the force charge either. Now, transcendentalers can do that, but not finite beings. Okay, it's not a measurable differential. You know, it can't make any sort of a needle on a dial move from zero. You know, measuring how big the differential is. That's all those dials are. No differential, more differential, more the meter moves. Right, your speedometer. You know, what's your differential from stationary? You know, all these things are, you know, all these measurement devices are telling you the magnitude of a differential. Let's see, there was something, yeah.
Being able to understand what is in the absinthe level, understanding that, and then knowing, you know, just basically knowing it exists, and then having material or, you know, mind or understanding what we can, the parts we can understand, would inform the parts we can understand. Just understanding that exists.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's impossible to put together a logical understanding of the finite if you don't know of the existence of the absinthe. You have to include the existence of the absinthe in the picture, even though you're not going to have an absinthe science, you have to have an absinthe philosophy behind your finite science. Okay, the fact that current science invokes magic all the time, you know, that's why. Without the absinthe, any finite science will invariably embody magic in order to get the correct answer. It can't be logical without an absinthe, without the inclusion of the fact of the absinthe in the understanding, in the picture.
I thought I said earlier that, you know, that absinthe being transcendental or whatever, that they very rarely, you know, reveal that in a local universe. You know what I'm saying?
Not the early, yes, they, you know what I'm they saying? They very they don't normally reveal the architects of the master universe, but the absinthe is obvious. I mean, we should have figured out the existence of the absinthe by ourselves without the revelation 100 years ago.
Oh, really?
It's trivially obvious that it exists logically just from our observations 100 years ago.
Well, that's funny. I've been reading this book for umpteen years, and I still don't really totally understand it.
I mean,
Well,
one of the things that we're gonna try to, you know, improve upon is our understanding of the absinthe and going through this paper, okay? But you know, there were observations that were made around the beginning of the 20th century that suggest that you have a phenomenon that's transfinite, and you go, well, so does that mean that phenomenon is absolute? It's like, well, that doesn't seem logical. It can't be. That isn't like a godlike phenomenon or something. I mean, no. So it's not finite, you know, but it's more than finite. It's obviously super finite, but as super finite as absolute is obviously too much. It can't be that transfinite, huh? There must be something in between the finite and the absolute. Just trying to logically understand the observations forces you to coin a term that's in between finite and absinthe. It's like, well, why don't we take take two chunks of the words and glue them together? Absinthe, absolute, finite.
Between finite and absolute.
Yeah, did I say
finite and absolute?
Yeah, between finite and absolute. There has to be something between the finite and the absolute. Just the observations demand it logically. But see, at the same time that those observations were being thought about initially, we were throwing out logic. So it's just at the time when there were observations that would have forced us logically to recognize the existence of the absonite, we were deciding that logic was an illusion, and so we were never inexorably driven to that conclusion. Instead, we decided that the universe was inherently illogical, that logic actually has always been just a delusion and should be just thrown out, and magic is okay. Right? See, so the moment that you assume that magic is okay, you're never inexorably driven to the recognition of the absonite. Yeah. You didn't, see, that's the irony. We should have figured it out before the Urantia book, and we didn't.
As soon as you toss God out of the picture, there's no way that the science can develop a transfinite.
See, but that's what I'm trying to say. That's not the case. You can throw God totally out of the picture. You don't need God to logically conclude the existence of the absonite, of the transfinite. It's a trivial observation that we made 100 years ago. The speed of light is not a function of time and space. It's not relative. To be relative is to be finite. Okay? And you're going, oh, so the speed of light is absolute? No, that doesn't seem right. I mean, I'm measuring it with finite instruments. That seems totally overkill to decide that the speed of light is a manifestation of an absolute phenomenon. This non-relative speed is a manifestation of an absolute phenomenon. Okay, so if it's not as high as absolute, but it's obviously transfinite because it's not, I mean, it's not finite. It's not relative. Therefore, it's just by definition not finite. So it's obviously something in between the absolute and the finite. Right? You don't need God at all. If anything, if you're trying to throw out God, that might have been why you threw out the assumption that it's an absolute, that it's an expression of some absolute phenomenon and its transfiniteness. I mean, throwing out God maybe would help you to get the absonite. See?
Yeah, and getting the absonite would help you throw out God.
But now, of course, once you definitively have, that there must be something that's transfinite, they think, well, that kind of forces me to believe there must be an absolute as well. You could have taken these baby steps up, there's got to be something transfinite. And then logically, if there's a transfinite, there must be an absolute. I mean, again, the existence of an absolute is also demanded logically. But if you throw out logic, then you don't need an absolute. Okay, let's do here first.
Fourth question.
Holy cow.
What about the cosmic rays generated by the X-ray phenomenon? Do they have some measurable power?
Yeah, we'll get to issues of waves and force charges and stuff later on in the paper.
Chris, what about the observations you were talking about that we saw that was transfinite?
That's what I was just describing, the speed of light.
Okay.
The speed of light is, you can do anything that you want, trying to get so that you're moving towards it, or moving away from it, or moving sideways from it, to try to somehow, vary it. What the relative speed is, and you can't do anything to make it relative. It just stays the same speed no matter what you do. You measure the speed of this photon coming at you, when you're going at it or when you're going away from it, and you get the same speed, If I measure the relative speed between me and a train when I'm in a little car on the tracks moving at the same speed of the train, what speed do I get for the train? Zero. I don't get the same speed as I get if I step off the tracks and watch the train zip by. I get a totally different relative speed. That isn't the way it works with light. You, no matter what you do, you get the same speed, same relative speed. That means it's not finite. It's not relative. Right? The only way that you could, it could possibly be transcendent of all your actions is if it's transfinite. Okay.
Do you have other things in mind here besides quantum physics?
Yeah, I mean, all of the primary 20th century theories are magical. General relativity, quantum, you know, physics, etc., quantum mechanics. All those basic theories are magical theories.
Transfinity is not relative. What is relative then? Is that finite?
I'm not following that. Transfinite is in transfinite? Yeah.
Transfinity is not relative. What is relative then?
Oh, okay.
Finity.
Yeah.
Oh,
okay, I see
you.
Yeah, I see what they're getting at there. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good job.
Okay. Any other question over here?
When did logic go out the window? Did it happen at some particular point through some particular philosopher who went insane?
No. It was gradual over several decades, you know.
You should know that through
But
awakening philosophy too.
It was a gradual thing. There were some punctuated, you know, pushes in the midst of it. You know, when Einstein, basically gave up on inductive reasoning and said that initial assumptions need to be free inventions of the human mind.
Yeah.
Okay, you know, that's opening the door. It's a process of just. Losing our way. I mean, it began with the philosophers in the second half of the 19th century, beginning to fuzz people's minds. And then that fuzzing got filtered down to the science, and just people were sort of, had been primed to be open to magic again, and they didn't recognize that they were. And it was actually a long time before they sort of consciously recognized that they were believing what used to be called magic and calling it science.
Wasn't science part of philosophy at one time, and then it split off? Is that when this...
Right, I mean, philosophy kind of began as the beginnings of science and developed beyond merely science over time. You know, and then especially as you got into the Enlightenment, the special sciences started to really break off. But see, they can think they're breaking off, but as I was trying to point out, I mean, no one is born and lives in a vacuum. Right? I mean, you're born and live in an environment, a philosophic environment, and if that philosophic environment is getting fuzzy, it doesn't matter how much you think you're this cold hard scientist that is broken from all philosophic foolishness. You're bathing in it from the moment you're born, and it will creep in unconsciously into your thinking, and the next thing you know, you've got an illogical science. Okay, all right, so meanwhile, back to that final sentence. So the first measurable form of energy, I got that point in play. Now, the automaton has paradises as its nucleus. We've talked about here that just recently, but let's stress it again, that we're basically going to be talking about finite measurable phenomena. But understanding that logically, there's that which underlies that finite manifestation. One of the things that's obvious that must underlie the finite manifestation, you study the finite manifestations, and you notice that they have a universal fact in common. An aspect of their nature in common, that finite phenomena are nucleated, that there's some sort of a centering influence in play. things tend to be spheres of finite manifestation. Something is influencing that finite phenomenon so that it is nucleated, so that it is there, you know, some kind of centering influence. And logically, if I, you know, if I have this little like electron, you know, that I'm studying moving around in space, you know, I notice logically that no matter where that little ball is, that little billiard ball-like thing, that little particle is, it's nucleated. It feels the exact same nucleating influence here and here and here and here as I, you know, imagine I move it around in front of me. There's some sort of uniform nucleating influence. It doesn't vary with space and time. It's not like when I move the electron a foot that suddenly it's bigger or smaller or something. It stays the exact same nucleated little sphere. You know, and I can sit and stare at it for weeks and weeks on end and it doesn't blow up or collapse. I mean, it's just, it has this very rock solid nucleation expression, a given radius. Right. You're going, oh, okay, so that there's some sort of a centering, nucleating influence that's also transfinite, because it's not a function of space and time. It's not relative, space and time. What's that? It's obviously transfinite. That is actually an absolute influence. Right? The Isle of Paradise. Yeah. Right? Yeah. There's an absolute centering influence that imposes itself from outside of space and time onto space and time. You know, and let's just think space. You know, every point in space is touched equally from the outside by the influence of the Isle, the centering influence of the Isle. It's the absolute of individuality. You know, it's this individuating influence, a centering influence, you know, an influence that's doesn't want things to be a continuum. Unity is continuumness. This is individuality. It's the absolute of individuality, the Isle. All right, so, you know, as I pointed out, so, you know, it's in that sense. The influence of the Isle is always at the center of every finite phenomenon. You know, the Isle literally isn't, because it's an absolute fact, and an absolute fact can't be literally in the finite. Okay? But you could ask, well, if it's just an absolute fact, and I'm talking about just finite expressions, what bridges the gap between the two? You know, something has downstepped the influence of the Isle and brought it into relationship with the finite. Because it can't be self-downstepping, right? I mean, it wouldn't be absolute. I mean, it's just absolute, period. It's not also absentite and finite, and it can kind of go up and down its elevator, you know, and manifest at different levels or something. It's just purely absolute. So what gets its influence from there to, you know, the point that I'm imagining in front of me that there's an electron or an ultimaton? What could downstep vertically like that? Absolutely. You know, what could downstep? Right, we're moving towards that. See, all these things are between the lines, what we're moving towards. We're moving towards the thing that actually has, in and of itself, a vertical nature, the Paradise Trinity. This distinction is vital. For in a cosmic system, the individual members are not connected with each other, except in relation to the whole, and through the individuality of the whole. The Isle of Paradise can't be connected to the center of an ultimaton, except in relation to the whole, and through the individuality of the whole. Okay? Because the ultimaton is a finite fact, and the Isle of Paradise is an absolute fact, and there's a very large gap between the two of them, neither of which they can transcend themselves, you know, bridge themselves. What bridges the gap? Right? The one vertical Well, you know, and the derivative of that vertical fact, you know, the Paradise Trinity, the whole, and Mother Deity, the individuality of the whole. You got something?
Yeah, I was wanting to say this a little bit ago when you were first talking about how you can observe the wet ground or something. It stays the same, it doesn't change or get bigger or whatever. Just that one recognition, observation and recognition, brings me to my knees. That there's a centering influence that is all around us and part of us. And oh my gosh.
Right. You know, and think about, you know, go beyond the physics, you know, talking about literal physics stuff with particles and stuff for a moment. If you succeed in bringing your mind to a focus, how did you do that? Did you do that in relationship to the Universal Father? No. You did that in relationship to the centering influence, the aisle. Nothing is individuated. Nothing comes to a focus like that except in relation to the aisle. It is the absolute of centering like that. To be grounded, focused, centered, you know, is to be grounded on the aisle, to be in relationship to the aisle. Okay? Even for your personality, you know, that individuation of will, even for your personality to be individuated from the wholeness of some reservoir, it can't be individuated except relative to the aisle. The Father in and of himself can't individuate a personality. You know, that individuation happens via his relationship to the absolute of individuality, the aisle. Or a thought adjuster. A thought adjuster can't be individuated. Everything is individual relative to the aisle. Yeah. Period. Just completely universally.
Forgive me. When I think of the Isle of Paradise and I go there in my mind when I meditate, I immediately am on a lawn chair drinking a Mai Tai in Hawaii, you know, on the ocean. And I'm curious to hear your explanation of the Isle of Paradise in a human state.
Well, see, what we're talking, you know, we're bringing in, there's one, it's one thing to actually go there and recline in a lawn chair, okay? One day you'll do that, okay? But the magnificent thing is you can benefit from the aisle long before you're a resident of the aisle and are given a paradise lawn chair, okay? Right here and now, you can benefit from the grounding of the aisle. If you take delight in cultivating, having a relationship to the whole and the individuality of the whole. You know, if you take delight in being really living, this distinction is vital, you know, to be living, right? To be really living. This distinction is vital, for in a cosmic system, the individual members are not connected with each other except in relation to the whole. And through the individuality of the whole. It is the fundamental revelation of the fifth epical revelation. It's the answer to the question, why is my life not grounded? Why is my life not stable? I mean, Jesus gave you a hint 2,000 years ago. He said, why are you building on sand? Shouldn't you be building on rock? What is the rock? The aisle is the rock that he was talking about building on. Build your life on the aisle now. Okay? Put the lawn chair in your mind on the aisle, not on the sandbar in your mind. Put it on the aisle. Okay? Get your life grounded, especially if you have desire to do really fancy, you know, outward-directed things. Are you going to be successful if you start by plopping your lawn chair on a sandbar? No. Jesus told you that 2,000 years ago. Don't do that. You're not going to like the results.
Don't do that.
See, now we know, you know, what he was actually talking about. You know, he wasn't going to bring up the literalness of the aisle and the absolute of centering influence, all this sort of stuff. He, you know, we understand now. You got to be grounded. You have to choose to have a relationship to the aisle. The only source of stability. Everything else is moving. There's only one thing that's stationary. There's only one way in the entire cosmos infinite to have a stable life. It's not the Father, it's not the Son, it's not the Spirit, it's not a trillion other things you can think of. There's only one thing in the entire cosmos infinite upon which you can build a stable life. The one stationary fact, the aisle.
How do I know when I've located the aisle?
There will be a constancy, a stability, you know, a consistency. That's how it manifests. You know, like you were just recognizing that the fact that you can watch the electron move around and its mass and its radius don't change. It's not a fluctuating, unstable phenomenon like we tend to be when we're not grounded on the aisle. We're puffed way up and then we collapse back down and we puff up again and then we collapse back down and right. And we fuzz out, and you know, why do our lives like that? It's because you know we don't have that centering influence there, you know, that's absolutely not a function of space and time. Every moment, you know, is exactly like the former. Every place is like the preceding. You know, you have this uniformity now in your life in relationship to the eternalness of the aisle. okay. Right. So that's what they're reminding us. We obviously have transfinite phenomena. Some of them are absonite. Some of them are absolute. The fact that mass is not a function of space and time. Again, I mean, the moment that we recognize that mass was not a function of space and time, that proves there's transfinite. Logically. So how come the word absonite isn't in science books right now? Because there's no logic in science books. Every single universal constant is proof of the transfinite. Every universal constant is not a function of space and time. That means it's by definition not finite. It's transfinite. Planck's constant, gravitational constant, you know, you name it. The Boltzmann constant, all those constants that aren't a function of space and time, those are proof of the transfinite. And then charge is not a function of space and time. Mass is not a function of space and time. The only way that could possibly be is if there's transfinite, logically. Right, it's just trivially obvious. It's hidden in plain sight. I mean, this everywhere you turn in science, it's screaming logically, transfinite.
What logic? There is none.
But instead, you get this dogmatic repetition that everything is relative. No, lots of things are not relative, like the speed of light. I pointed that out. You know, they say everything is relative. You know, what they believe is a conclusion of the special theory of relativity. That they didn't generalize into a complete lifestyle solution. No, the initial assumption of deriving those equations of relativity is that there's at least one thing that's not relative, the speed of light. So obviously the conclusion isn't that everything is relative. You only derived those equations by assuming that at least one thing wasn't.
Perfect.
Right? Again, simple logic, yep.
To make it a little more practical then, have a relationship with the aisle means consecration of mind through choices and decisions.
Right. I mean, when Jesus said, I'm absolutely confident my Heavenly Father's overcare, no real harm can befall me, he's speaking that he's standing on the rock. He says that because he moves his feet. He goes, nope, I'm not standing on sand. I'm standing on the aisle. Therefore, no real harm can befall me. If I'm standing on the aisle, what could move me? The aisle is motionless. It's unmovable. Right? Right? That's the only way, is if you identify with the, you know, the rock that is the isle, only then will the vicissitudes be overcome in your life. You know, as long as you're reaching for something else, you know, Bob's going to help you with a potion or something. It's not going to work. Bob is not the isle. Only the isle is the isle. No potion is the isle. You know, no desire is the isle. Only the isle is the isle. You have to let go and just, you know, take a hold of that which does not move. And then you will begin to be like that. Slowly but surely, your life will begin to settle down. It's, you know, it is the means for making your life objective. It starts out basically totally subjective and subject to everything. Like a sandbar is subject to every wave. Right? You start out being subject to every wave. The isle's not subject to any waves. Nothing can move it. All right.
There is innate in matter and present in universal space a form of energy not known on Urantia. When this discovery is finally made, then will physicists feel that they have solved, almost at least, the mystery of matter. And so will they have approached one step nearer the Creator. So will they have mastered one more phase of the divine technique. But in no sense will they have found God. Neither will they have established the existence of matter or the operation of natural laws, apart from the cosmic technique of paradise and the motivating purpose of the Universal Father.
Okay, so a little bit of science, you have future science and the philosophic things that haven't changed, they're reminding you of there. So start out with, many, many times, and we'll see it, you know, in this paper, they speak of what they speak of there in the beginning. And they speak of an energy that's not known, you know, or is unknown, you know, or some words to that effect. Not yet discovered, whatever they say, okay? When they're talking about that, you know, that way we don't know anything about it, they're telling you. They're talking about the sub-electronic domains of energy. Okay. There's a few times when they speak of something that you know, they say you have some vague sense of that you know that you're or whatnot. But when they tell you that you don't know anything about it, what they're talking about is the sub-electronic domain. Okay. The basic nature of an atom hinges, as they're saying there, hinges upon a sub-electronic phenomena. That's why that sub-electronic environment can possibly make the stability, affect the stability of that atom. You know, it could be a radioactive isotope. Okay? Because it fundamentally is held together by this sub-electronic nature of things. So, without going into, you know, we'll get into some of those details later in the paper, but that's what they're referring to. I hate to kind of snatch that away, but all those times when they talk about this energy that you haven't discovered yet, it's like, oh, I got to try to see if I can discover that. I need to take my electronic level device and see if I can find this unknown energy. No, you're not going to find it because it's not measurable with an electronic level device. So they're pointing out, one day we're going to begin to recognize and start to be able to measure sub-electronic phenomena. You know, and just recognizing it and being able to properly, logically rationalize the way an atom works, like they're saying, you know, we're going to think, wow, we've got this figured out now. I mean, we can calculate all the details of an atom from first principles, basically. Okay, and then they remind you, but in no sense will they have found God, and notice, it's like, well, of course not. Yeah, but notice what scientists are doing right now. They think that their current rationalization scheme is moving towards this state, and they're calling the Higgs boson the God particle.
Right.
Now, of course, what they're talking about here has nothing to do with all that Higgs boson stuff. And when I remember I was talking about that last time, that's going in the complete opposite direction. That's the very, very high electronic levels of energy. They're going in the opposite direction to what we're talking about here. We need to go sub-electronic, not super, or extreme electronic, let's say it that way, instead of super, extreme electronic like they're doing now.
That's the Higgs boson that they talk about, the great hope.
Right, it's just, it's a phantom of just the rationalization schemes of trying to understand all this very complicated high-energy stuff.
This is the hottest hope in science right now.
Well, I mean, it's the hottest hope for funding. It seems like it's the hottest hope to you because you hear the marketing campaign trying to get you to tell your congressman to give them more money.
Obviously the term subelectronic, I've heard of it many times, growing up as a kid. How does modern science describe or subelectronic?
Doesn't at all. There is no subelectronic in current science.
But I've heard the word before. I mean, what are they?
You've heard subatomic.
Oh, subatomic. Yeah.
Okay. You haven't heard subelectronic. You've heard subatomic particles.
Okay.
Right. And basically, what that is that's the electronic level. That's electrons, protons, etc.
Subelectronic would mean prior to electronic, or.
If you're thinking in an evolutionary sense, it's pre-electronic, obviously, if you're going up from force to energy to power. But just in an existential sense, it means you're going below the collection of 100 ultimatons, the electronic level, all the way down to one ultimaton. That whole range between a collection of 100 and one ultimaton, that's the subelectronic domain. Okay, which science knows nothing of. They don't think of a particle like an electron as being divisible. And it isn't billiard ball divisible. Remember, those 100 ultimatons aren't 100 smaller little billiard balls. Right? They're not billiard balls at all, those ultimatons. They're units of motion. Okay? Not units of matter. Not units of particleness, not units of billiard ballness, units of charge, units of mass, or anything like that.
We're stuck in the box.
They're units of motion.
Are they units of motion? Are they
self-animated? No, there's a difference between motion and animation. Now, not in a lot of current kind of fuzzy theories that play around with the ether and stuff like that. They blur primitive notions of life animation and ideas of motion together, and so you get this mystical spirit matter fuzz together theory. Especially if it's coming from an Eastern influence, it'll definitely have that the spirit and the matter fuzz together. Neither will they have established the existence of matter or the operation of natural laws apart from the cosmic technique of paradise and the motivating purpose of the Universal Father. Obviously, they're reminding you of that purposing that's behind everything, personality managed. But also, they're pointing out that this is just sort of stage one in an improved science, that you really understand sort of the basic superficial aspects or the experiential aspects, if you will, immediately measurable aspects of an atom. But what about its more existential nature? What about more fundamentally what that collection of 100 ultimatons is, or what an ultimaton is, and being able to measure that an ultimaton? Okay, that's you haven't gotten to that level yet as they're telling the story here. You still don't completely understand the existence of matter. right? And the basic laws that under, you know, that maintain that existence. You understand some of a deeper level of the phenomenology of matter. That's step one. Now, in the next paragraph, see, they take it further.
Subsequent to even still greater progress and further discoveries, after your answer has advanced immeasurably in comparison with present knowledge, though you should gain control of the energy revolutions of the electrical units of matter to the extent of modifying their physical manifestations, even after all such possible progress, forever will scientists be powerless to create one atom of matter or to originate one flash of energy or even to add to matter that which we call life.
Or ever to add. Yeah, forever, or ever to add to matter that which we call life.
Even kind of fit there too.
Well, you see, it's contrasting, you know, so. Okay.
What does your book say, even or
ever? All right. Even is in the first sense, though, subsequent to even still. Okay. All right, see, so there they're talking about, you know, taking it all the way to having a full ultimatonic physics, not just a sub-electronic physics, you know, to an initial degree, but a full sub-electronic physics all the way to a full ultimatonic physics. Okay, but still, even when you know things completely all the way down to the ultimatonic level, you know, there's no mysteries to, you know, that collection of 100 ultimatons, those 100 units of motion or anything anymore. And you can, you know, you can play with, like they're saying, you can play with this endlessly, you know, totally do the whole alchemy thing until you're blue in the face. All right.
Real gray, hot.
Still, what's going to be the case? Okay. No, you know, even when you have a full ultimatonic physics, you're not going to be able to grab a hold of the force charge of space and squeeze it into an ultimaton, individuate it into an ultimaton. You know, that's what I mean by creating one atom of matter. Remember, creation is never out of nothing. You know, kind of at a basic finite level, creating an ultimaton and, you know, using them to make an atom eventually, you know, is going from the force charge, the primordial force, to an ultimaton, okay? You're not going to be able to do that because, again, even with a full ultimatonic physics, you're not going to have a gizmo that can grab a hold of the force charge and do anything with it. It's not measurable. It's not tangible. It's, you know, it's not manipulable. Unless you're an absonite being, right? The force organizers are absonite beings, not finite beings, right? So they can grab a hold of it, do things with it. You also are not going to be able to originate one flash of energy. You know, so speaking in a more general sense, you know, you can take one, you know, measure of energy and modify it into a different flavor of energy, okay? But you can't bring something totally out of, you know, the background, out of force, into energy. Now, why did they, it's like, well, matter is energy. Why did they do two of them there? Okay. The second part, powerless to originate one flash of energy. What's the basic scientific principle that they're pointing out is definitively valid? The conservation of energy. Period. Okay. You know, we've gotten that far. All we need to do is generalize what, you know, what we understand the word energy to be. And we have the full truth. Energy is conserved, period. No finite process is going to create or destroy energy. Energy is conserved. Okay? E equals mc squared. It's like, well, we know about that. Isn't that like turning energy into matter or matter into energy, when, you know, to make that equation work? Well, no, they're both forms of energy. You're just changing it from one flavor to another flavor. Okay, and even at a more fundamental level, energy can't be by any finite process can't be turned back into force, or force can't be turned into energy. Energy is conserved, period. Now, there's a particular type of energy, that little individuation called an ultimaton. And yeah, in a general sense, they're an energy, and they're conserved. But they have a separate mention of that, because there's another way that you can understand a fundamental conservation law when you're talking about those little units that are ultimatons. The number of ultimatons is conserved. No finite process can destroy, create or destroy an ultimaton. Right? So that the way you would kind of relate that to end of the 19th century sort of expression, where they had the eternity of mass and the conservation of energy. It's the eternity of ultimatons, the number of ultimatons, and the conservation of energy. So that they're pointing out there's a truth to that. In a most general sense, it's conservation of energy, but just appreciating that specific sort of corollary of it, that the number of ultimatons has to be conserved in any finite process. We have all kinds of rationalization schemes about finite processes now where our rationalization scheme doesn't conserve the number of ultimatons. We think that something goes from what's actually a collection of 100 to two collections of 100. Okay, that's not a valid rationalization of that. That doesn't conserve ultimatons. Where did the other 100 ultimatons come from? Right? Oh, there must be another 100 on the before side. If there's 200 on the after side, there must be 200 on the before side. There's something that you don't recognize is there.
Throw it back in the collider.
Okay. All right. No amount of finite ability is going to allow you to bestow life animation. Okay. Only a creator involved process can bestow life animation. I mean, a life carrier, it's bestowed through a life carrier, but not from a life carrier. It's from Creative Mother Spirit, and even higher, it's from higher up, but, right, so they're just reminding you that you're never going to be able to play with that very intangible fact of life animation, and you're never going to be able to play with that very intangible fact of primordial force. Those are beyond your reach, period.
Good.
Yeah.
It's a blessing.
It's a good thing. Yeah.
So when we do things like cloning, things like that, we're just taking life and moving it from here to here.
Well, I mean, there's life in play. I mean, like, right, I mean, it's just, yeah. I mean, it's been put into the system, and it's just pervades the system, right? I think that's... when they're talking about, maybe just one little note, when they're talking about even though you should gain control of the energy revolutions of the electrical units, I've been trying to allude to that. Talking about electronic level energy, think about a rotational motion, revolution like motion, because it obviously has to be contained. It can't. If you're going to think of a universe of motion, you can't think of open motion like translational motion. I mean, how could there be particles if everything was just, flying every which direction? Okay. In order for it to be a universe of motion, that motion must have a closed nature in some way. It must chase its tail in some way, right? In order to masquerade to a degree as if it was a little billiard ball, right? If it's actually a motion, it must be some sort of a closed form motion. So you see, the revelators will talk about the revolution of things, right? Because you're talking about a closed form motion. You're talking about that matter is a motion. All right.
The creation of energy and the bestowal of life are the prerogatives of the Universal Father and his associate creator personalities. The river of energy and life is a continuous outpouring from the deities, the universal and united stream of paradise force going forth to all space. This divine energy pervades all creation. The force organizers initiate those changes and institute those modifications of space force which eventuate in energy. The power directors transmute energy into matter. Thus, the material worlds are born. The life carriers initiate those processes in dead matter, which we call life, mortal, material life. The Marantia power supervisors likewise perform throughout the transition realms between the material and the spiritual worlds. The higher spirit creators inaugurate similar processes in divine forms of energy, and there ensue the higher spirit forms of intelligent life.
Okay, so you can see why.
What's going on here, huh?
Right, and they're just kind of rattling through all of the issues that go beyond sort of what's going to be the immediate subject that we're going to be studying in this paper. And you say, well, okay, I'm a longtime student. I get that. I mean, obviously, we're not going to be talking about what the bodies of seraphim are made out of or divine counselors or stuff like that. Why are you bringing this all up? Well, they're bringing it up because I alluded to it just a little bit ago. You have some alternative theories floating out there that don't properly keep this stuff separated. They blur in, in a crude way, are shades of these other things: spirit, Marantia, life animation, mind, etc. And they blur it into their physical theory, and get this groovy mystical theory, and they'll use Sanskrit words to describe it and stuff, right? All those are separate issues. Now, the other thing that they threw in there, say the life carriers initiate those processes in dead matter, which we call life, and then they say, comma, material life. And you're going, well, why did they add the parenthetical? Again, in the basic sense of thinking about where life animation, quote unquote, the fact called life animation, where that fits into the picture as something that's bestowed, is when you have just a material being, or body, identity, that you're going to animate. The other things, when there's Marantia substance or an absinthe blended like spirit, quote unquote, substance like the body of a seraphim or things like that, there's spirit energy innately in it, and spirit energy is self-animating. So you don't add life animation to that. It's already there. Yeah. Okay? But, so that's why they're calling me. The only time that you're sort of literally adding life animation is when the body is made out of dead matter. And then you have to add the animation. Otherwise, the animation is already there. So that when a creator son and creator mother spirit, make the beings of the local universe, like they're talking about, in the last sentence there, the life animation thing is just innately in play in the bringing the body of the being into existence. It's animate. We were just talking about previously, bringing in the force organizers. Only those force organizers can initiate those changes and institute those modifications of space force which eventuate in energy. It takes an absinthe being and a particular flavor of absinthe being, the ones that can grip primordial force like they can, do the things with it that they do, which is basically completely mysterious even to the revelators, because it's an absinthe process, and the revelators are finite beings, and they don't understand such things. Okay. So it's a mystery to them, too. They just know the basics of the steps, but they don't understand the how of it. It's completely transcendent of their comprehension abilities.
Pay grade.
Okay.
Who wrote your paper?
This is a mighty messenger. That,
so he's been through a lot.
Yeah, right. And it doesn't matter, what it is, universal sense or divine counsel or whatever the heck you want to imagine. Right? They don't. They're finite beings, and they can't understand absentite things. All right. Let's see. Now, the one other thing to note there, they're transitioning to the next paragraph. Like I said, they've been slowly but surely kind of saying things that suggest something beyond just the seven absolutes of infinity. Especially beyond just having the universal father be behind everything, you know, be the micromanager of everything. Notice the wording there towards the beginning of that paragraph. The river of energy and life is a continuous outpouring of the deities, you know, not the gods. See, so they're beginning to move away from personalized deity, the personality thing, and having a causal agent, you know, the personality management part of the understanding. You know, a little bit less of that kind of ultimate why of it all. But they're trying to get you to the how. They're trying to get you more to the science. Okay? And the transition is to set this personality side part aside and think about deity. You know, and what's the super additive consequence of the deity of those three infinite persons? There's another facet of deity, the Paradise Trinity. Right? That's what they're moving towards. Okay, so you see here in the next paragraph.
Energy proceeds from paradise, fashioned after the divine order. Energy, pure energy, partakes of the nature of the divine organization. It is fashioned after the similitude of the three gods embraced in one. What did you just say? As they function in the headquarters of the universe of universes. And all force is circuited in paradise, comes from the paradise presences, and returns thereto, and is in essence a manifestation of the uncaused cause, the universal father. And without the father, would not anything exist that does exist.
Okay, so the last part, see again, it's still there. Kind of, yeah, even throwing in kind of biblical-like speak, you know, even. So you feel comfortable. But it is in essence a manifestation of the uncaused cause. Yeah, that's, you know, again, shading it a little bit. But as you pointed out, as you were reading, you see in the middle there, okay? So take even that very foundational differential that in most of the time is not called an energy but a force because of its transcendent, the transcendence of the differential, that pure energy, and which they said is sort of a direct, you know, is directly controlled by the universal father. It's like, case in point, take that fact. Is primordial force, is pure energy, fashioned after the similitude of the universal father? No. Is it fashioned after the similitude of the eternal son? No. Is it fashioned after the similitude of the conjoint actor or the infinite spirit, you know, whichever name you want to use for the third source and center? No. It is fashioned after the similitude of the three gods embraced in one, i.e., the Paradise Trinity. There is only one facet of deity, as they tell you towards the end of the foreword, that directly embraces reality in its wholeness. Not father-type deity, not son-type deity, not spirit-type deity, or any other flavor of deity you can think of. The Paradise Trinity is the only deity that directly embraces, directly engages the wholeness of reality. The other facts, like say the Eternal Son, embrace reality part-wise. And even that is in quotes. I mean, they only embrace it part-wise through that which embraces it whole-wise. There's only one direct engagement of reality, and it's a holistic engagement. And don't spell holistic with just an H. Put a W in front of it so that it doesn't shade you so much to health like things, but think more philosophically. You know, so W-H-O-L-E. You know, that kind of holistic. The Paradise Trinity. You can't have a true science until you have the Paradise Trinity in the picture. That's the how, the fundamental how of everything. And like I was pointing out at the beginning, how they were, when they were mentioning, you know, sort of three different ways of grabbing a hold of stuff, right? And trying to, like I said, remind you that even if you're just focusing on the matter, you don't want to forget that there's mind and spirit. Okay, why don't you want to? Because the fact that makes it a cosmic system, that makes it something that is logical and can be studied and understood, is the engagement of the Paradise Trinity. And the Paradise Trinity doesn't just grab a hold of matter or mind or spirit. It grabs a hold of the triunity of matter, mind, and spirit. Technically, that's the only thing that is grabbable, is the triunity. And if there's some quasi-independent manipulation of spirit, say from the absolute spirit, the eternal Son, that happens through the Paradise Trinity. There's only one upfront fact, the Paradise Trinity. Everyone else is behind the scenes, you know. And if the Father wants to have a direct influence, yeah, he can, but this distinction is vital. Right? In a cosmic system, the individual members are not connected to each other except in relation to the whole and through the individuality of the whole. His influence can only get to where he wants it to go, and it's going to be a part-wise influence. It can only get there in relation to the whole and through the individuality of the whole, in relation to the Paradise Trinity and through the Mother. It's the only way any of those things can happen. The only way that the three infinite persons can do anything in a coordinate fashion. They're not self-coordinating. They're absolutely independent, etc. The Paradise Trinity and Mother Deity, the whole and the individuality of the whole is the key. The reason, the fundamental reason we don't have a true science right now is because we have a father-like science. The Father is the individuality of the parts. We have a part-wise science, and that is not true. Fundamentally, science is a holistic fact. You need a Trinity mother-like science in order to have a true science. You fundamentally have to have the whole, a holistic concept at the foundation of what your theory, of your understanding.
Well, the implication is when the Father acts, that there's a law of conservation in place.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the Trinity.
Right. See, because of that fundamental wholeness, you can see why there can be why there's conservation laws. You know, because the whole engages reality, you know, there's no way that you can do something, you know, genuinely independent of the whole. You know, it's always, you know, you're just shuffling things, like you think of conservation of energy. You're just modifying the expression of energy. You know, it can't get outside of the embrace of the whole, right? So, and yeah, including the Father. See, to come to this recognition, the first thing that the Father did in order to put himself into play was put himself in cooperative subordination to the Paradise Trinity. Because there's only one way to get to anything, and it's through the whole. Yeah. So that's a lesson for us, too. See, you know, we'd like to have an impact on the world. There's only one way to have an impact on the world that will be lasting. It won't be just an illusion. It's in relation to the whole and through the individuality of the whole. That's the only way to get to the outer life, to get your dreams of in your inner life to actually lastingly affect the outer life. No amount of consecration of your will to the perfect will of God the Father actually gets it done. That potentializes it, but it doesn't actualize it. You have to consecrate your mind to the universal harmony of God the Mother. You have to have the, you know, a thought construct that is holistic. Otherwise, there's no way for it to actually have the rubber meet the road, because it's got to go through the hole to get to the, you know, to the road. You know, a part, remember how it tells you that, you know, a half-hearted effort is of no avail? It's because you can take a half-hearted thing and try to resonate it with the whole, because the whole is what actually will deliver it. And the whole says, no, that's not holistic. I can't hold that. Try again. You know, everything you try to put out something that's not holistic, it gets rejected by the Paradise Trinity. You know, and not because it's, you know, dissing you, right? It's just because it's like, I'm sorry, I can't hold non-holistic things. You've got to give me a holistic fact. That's the only thing I can hold.
Even with a revelation, is the reality of the Trinity likely to become visible prior to a Trinity teacher son or something of the sort?
For those of you on the web, he's asking about, how likely is this to manifest, these issues about the Trinity? I mean, that's the key about the fifth epical revelation. It's the first epical revelation of the Paradise Trinity and the Mother. We've had four epical revelations and now a fifth epical revelation of God the Father. But we now have the first epical revelation of the other half of the story. We've had a lot of revelation of how it is that you became a part. How you can say, I am. The Father is behind that fact, that you are. He's the individuality of the parts. He made you a part. Potentially a part in eternity, in infinity. But it's the first epical revelation of the rest of the story. How can this part effectively do something, be effective in what I'd like to do? How can I not be regretting the past, whining over the present, and vainly hoping for the future? How can I get over that roadblock? I have all of this desire, and it just never works. I put it out there with all kinds of zeal. I will it as much as I can, and it just does not work. It falls flat on its face. Why? Because it wasn't holistic. I thought it was holistic. Well, if it actually genuinely was holistic, it would have succeeded. Simple litmus test. Right? Okay, that's what we're getting at. And see, it's not just all of these kind of personal things and, you know, religious things. Literally, science. If you're going to have a true science, you can't do it without the recognition of the Paradise Trinity and the Mother. That's how you finally get a true science. Things relate in systems, not in parts. You know, two parts relate through the individuality of the whole, not from part to part, like our current father-like theories believe. Nothing relates part to part. Everything relates through the individuality of the whole. So if your theory doesn't have some way of systematizing parts, if it just plops parts out there and rationalizes them together, it's not a true science. It has to somehow incorporate a whole and an individuality of a whole. The question is, how do you do that? How do you formulate a theory like that? Okay.
Force derived from self-existent deity is in itself ever-existent. Force energy is imperishable, indestructible. These manifestations of the infinite may be subject to unlimited transmutation, endless transformation, and eternal metamorphosis, but in no sense or degree, not even in the slightest imaginable extent, could they, or ever shall they, suffer extinction. But energy, though springing from the infinite, is not infinitely manifest. There are outer limits to the presently conceived master universe.
Okay, just a couple things there. If you've taken the Total Deity seminar, you see things there that you recognize. And it starts out self-existent deity. You go, oh, wait a minute, that's the label for the infinite as a facet of deity. And sure enough, they proceed to, you know, use that designation, the infinite. But then you notice, oh, yeah, but they're not using it as a facet of deity. Oh, they're using that designation from the individuality viewpoint as that the reservoir of, you know, that sort of a very initial reservoir of all that could ever be in all of an infinite eternity. You know, that sort of really primal reservoir individuality viewpoint mode. But you see that, so they're playing deity and reality together. Just note that. Yeah, you can see why they brought that in, because they want to have the motivation for that last line. The master universe is not the cosmos infinite. It's really, really big, but, you know, even, you know, especially when it's completed. But it's not the cosmos infinite. It's limited, you know, even spatially. All right, so that giant question mark is like, well, what's...
Yeah. Know,
what about infinity? Well, you're going to have to go beyond the absinite and the ultimate. The other fun little thing in there, just the other fun thing for you to just play around with, look at how much fun they had with basically synonyms. Unlimited transmutation, endless transformation, and eternal metamorphosis. Look up those three words, the etymology of those three words, and see if you can appreciate what shades of difference they were playing on. You know, especially transformation and metamorphosis is basically saying exactly the same thing. You know, morphe is form, and meta is another, is being used there basically as a synonym for the prefix trans. And then transmutation, that, you know, mutation, change. So, just, you know, they're always having fun like that and playing with words, subtle differences, wanting you to reflect on, well, when should I use metamorphosis and when should I use transformation? There's a subtle difference there. What's the sense of it? Okay, let's keep reading.
Energy is eternal, but not infinite. It ever responds to the all-embracing grasp of infinity. Forever, force and energy go on. Having gone out from paradise, they must return thereto, even if age upon age be required for the completion of the ordained circuit. That which is of paradise deity origin can have only a paradise destination or a deity destiny.
Yeah, just look at how they're getting you to reflect on the difference between destination and destiny there. Yeah. You know, this spatial aspect of destination in contrast to the more, you know, philosophic generalization of destiny. The beginning there, it ever responds to the all-embracing grasp of capital I infinity. What does capital I infinity mean? The functioning of deity on the infinite level. Right? So, you know, they mentioned the infinite. They're doing it in a different way. Capital I infinity, the functioning of deity on the infinite levels. Okay, so they're taking me all the way up. Well, what's one of the things that if I know total deity, that reminds me of, capital I infinity? Well, how about the universal one of infinity? One side of which is the Paradise Trinity. The all-embracing grasp of that side of the universal one of infinity, the Paradise Trinity. Yeah, it's all embracing, embraces the triunity, the totality of reality, and embraces infinity. Right, so see, they're throwing in all these little, you know, hints at the deity perspective and the reality perspective together. So that if you're an advanced student, you can play all those thoughts together in your mind and appreciate it in a more holistic, in a more complete fashion. All right.
And all this confirms our belief in a circular, somewhat limited, but orderly and far-flung universe of universes. If this were not true, then evidence of energy depletion at some point would sooner or later appear. All laws, organizations, administration, and the testimony of universe explorers, everything points to the existence of an infinite God, but as yet a finite universe, a circularity of endless existence, well nigh limitless, but nevertheless finite in contrast with infinity.
Right. So both, in the sense that it's a closed system in the literal spatial sense, that there are, boundaries of the master universe. That, obviously when they talk about explorers, they're really bringing in that, but not just spatial explorers, but detail explorers of, what's within. And they're alluding to how it's a closed system in that these finite phenomena are not created or destroyed. They've never found an automaton to wink out of existence, via any finite process. So that's, they're just stressing that again, that the most, the highest order of observers don't just believe in the conservation of energy in automatons. They've endlessly put it to the test for trillions and trillions of years in every way, shape, and form they can think of. And they've found it to be true. How do you eventually come to the belief that something is true? It's because you've attempted to refute it, and refute it, and refute it, and refute it, and you cannot refute it. All of these countless beings in the universe of universes have been trying for trillions of years to refute these things, and they can't. Therefore, they know them to be true. They use the scientific method, the true scientific method. Okay?
So they figured it out versus God telling them.
Most of the things that they keep asking and no one will tell them. Why? Because that's the whole point is to come into relationship to truth through an experiential process. We're experiential beings. No one, not even divine counselors, is handed everything, on a silver platter, existentially. For it to be really true, to be realityized within you, it has to be acquired through an experiential process. Beings high and low.
Being who we are, if it was given to us, we wouldn't appreciate it.
Right. Again, see, that's the very fact that we say that, if it was just given to us, we wouldn't appreciate it. Why do you say that? Havona natives don't say that.
Gosh.
But people out here in the universe of universes, as ignorant as we are, say that. It's because it's a testimony. Wait a minute, I think I just, proved that I'm an experiential being. Otherwise, I wouldn't resonate with that sentence. That's what we are. Havona natives are just given things existentially, but we're given nothing, basically, or maybe I should say in the end, even that little bit that we're given by grace to begin with, as I've tried to point out, eventually you have to experientially acquire that yourself, and replace what you were given by fiat. It's just it's a catalyst to get you started. And a catalyst is not yours to possess eternally. Right? So that initial gift of grace, eventually has to be acquired through experiential processes of choosing. Okay, so you see, we were very much in a just slowly moving towards getting into the details of a direct science. You need the context for the science. And when all is said and done, see with that, you notice what, as I very much stressed, they're trying to get you from religion to science. That means they're trying to get you from the Universal Father to the Paradise Trinity. You've got to make that transition. Otherwise, you're just going to get some new theology that you're going to call science. And you will use religiosity words in it. okay? Inexorably. You need to get, you know, get that separated. The doorway from deity and religion to science, and there is only one doorway, is the Paradise Trinity. That is the interface between deity and reality. It is deity, yes, and it's the only facet of deity that directly embraces reality. It's the only way to get to the reality. It's the only way to get to your this. You're sparked in, you know, your process gets going by religion. You know, that's the motivation that gets you going. A true scientist begins as a religionist. And it begins with the Father, the sparking, the initiating of the Father. Okay? And the doorway that you're looking for to get over to the other side of the foundational level, from religion over to science, is the Paradise Trinity. That's the doorway. If you follow the Father all the way back to his roots, he's one side of the universal one of infinity, the first center. Go through to the other side, to the Paradise Trinity, and now you're ready to begin science. You're ready to begin by going through that which directly engages the reality that you'd like to study. Now, what science is about. Paradise Trinity is the key. You can't take your four epical revelations of the Father and turn them into a science. You get the kind of science we have right now, which is part-like, Father-like. You need the fifth epical revelation to get the true science. You need the Paradise Trinity. All right, let's take a moment to reflect on that.